Everyone may or may not have gotten my email this morning about the, I've started to edit the translation a little bit because I was trying to think how we might shorten the chanting, which now takes a good 10 minutes or more for all the verses. And I know many of us love to chant all the verses together every week, but it's starting to be a lot of time. So what I've done is experimented with altering the translation in certain cases so that the practice itself stands alone as a line or two that we can chant. I'm going to not accidentally do that, but share the screen. And we're going to experiment this week with just chanting the part that's in italics for each verse. And some of the verses I couldn't do, the whole Bodhisattva boot camp, because those tend to be shorter. I couldn't easily change those. So we're going to chant all of those because they are shorter as well. But this will give us a little more time for study. And then I appreciate feedback on this. If you think it works or if you think it doesn't work and you'd rather spend the time chanting together and take a little more time off studying, let me know. So this will be a bit of an adjustment, but just the italics. And I just want to say, sorry, when things are underlined, it means I changed that line. So that's just so that you know it's a little different than the translation was before. All right. Without distraction, always day and night, to study, contemplate, and meditate. This is the way a bodhisattva trains. To leave behind my habits and reactions, this home and where I've dwelt from life to life. This is the way a bodhisattva trains. On solitude and silence to rely, this is the way a bodhisattva trains. To let go of attachment to this lifetime, this is the way a bodhisattva trains. Not following the friends who harm my practice, this is the way a bodhisattva trains. To hold authentic Dharma friends more dear than even my own physical welfare, this is the way a bodhisattva trains. To seek refuge in Buddha, Dharma, Sangha, this is the way a bodhisattva trains. Therefore, even with my own life at stake, from harmful actions always to refrain, this is the way a bodhisattva trains. To strive in all our efforts to be free, this is the way a bodhisattva trains. To cultivate the mind of full awakening, this is the way a bodhisattva trains. To fully and wholeheartedly exchange my happiness for others' suffering, this is the way a bodhisattva trains. And now back to chanting full verses for a while. If someone driven by intense desire steals all my wealth or instigates the theft, to dedicate to them from all three kinds my wealth, good deeds, and merit, everything, this is the way a bodhisattva trains. Though I've not done the slightest thing that's wrong, without a cause someone cuts off my head, to generate compassion in my heart and take upon myself all their misdeeds, this is the way a bodhisattva trains. If someone slanders me and spreads the word, maligning me throughout the universe, to pay them back I fill my heart with love, extolling their good traits and character, this is the way a bodhisattva trains. If someone tells a crowd my hidden faults and speaks of me with undisguised contempt, to see them as my spiritual friend and bow sincerely with respect to them, this is the way a bodhisattva trains. If someone I've cared for as my own child turns on me as their worst enemy, then like a mother when her child is ill, to shower them with more love than before, this is the way a bodhisattva trains. If someone my inferior or peer through pride disparages and puts me down, to honor them as I would my teacher and place them reverently on my crown, this is the way a bodhisattva trains. And now back to italics. To take on all the suffering of beings, completely free of all discouragement, This is the way a bodhisattva trains. To see that there's no essence in success and never think I'm better than the rest. This is the way a bodhisattva trains. To tame my own mind with an army of the forces of compassion, kindness, love. This is the way a bodhisattva trains. Therefore, the moment that attachment stirs, to drop it right away without a pause. This is the way a bodhisattva trains. To know my own mind's nature and refrain from grasping onto subject-object signs. This is the way a bodhisattva trains. Okay, and full verse here. When I encounter something that's delightful, such as a rainbow on a summer day, to give up all attachment to its beauty and never cling to it is truly real. This is the way a bodhisattva trains. Italics. When I encounter adverse circumstances, to see them as delusions of my mind, this is the way a bodhisattva trains. And now verse 25, it has italics, but we'll do the whole verse because it is our verse this week. We will do this one three times. It's the first of the six paramitas to engage in generosity. If wishing to attain awakening, I need to give even my body up, then doesn't it go also without saying that this applies to mere external stuff, without hope for reward or benefit, to generously give away a gift? This is the way a bodhisattva trains. If wishing to attain awakening, I need to give even my body up, then doesn't it go also without saying that this applies to mere external stuff, without hope for reward or benefit, to generously give away a gift? This is the way a bodhisattva trains. If wishing to attain awakening, I need to give even my body up, then doesn't it go also without saying that this applies to mere external stuff, without hope for reward or benefit, to generously give away a gift? This is the way a bodhisattva trains. So anybody have any comments on that? The new sort of, the new way of possibly chanting the verses together. That was a thumbs up from Deidre. Okay. We'll probably mix and match. I'm gonna unmute Marilyn.
I would like just a bit slower chanting of the italicized ones, because I've looked by them before my mind is, yes, I know them, but I just renew the knowledge of them. So maybe just a little slower on the italicized ones.
Sure, yeah, that's true. It's like, we're doing it a different way now. But yeah, always good to chant a little slowly and mindfully. So I appreciate that comment. Anybody else have anything? Okay. Patrick.
Hi there. Just an editing point. It seems like sometimes you can get three of the verses at a time instead of jerking it up on one every time.
I'm not sure what you're saying there. Can you try to reword that?
I look at it. It's hard to focus on
screenshot.
It.
Screenshot.
The screenshot, when you roll it up,
uh-huh,
often is jerky, and I think if you could do like three at a time and then click a whole page worth.
Okay. All right. I'll try to remember to do that. Deidre's agreeing. I think those who have, like, it's not jerky on my screen. It may be jerky on everybody's screen but mine, but I think particularly if you haven't got a really strong connection, then things may be more jerky. So thanks for letting me know that.
Sure.
Okay. Anybody else? All right, I'm just going to write those couple of notes. Scroll slowly and chant slowly. Okay, otherwise I might forget. All right, anybody have any other comments or questions before we go into the study part? All right, and again, comments are also always welcome by email if you have something that you want to say at any time to share with me. All right, so first, verse 7 review. So we've been reviewing one verse, sometimes two verses per week, since we're so far along in the text. And today's verse is verse 7, the last of the preliminary verses. Who can the worldly deities protect themselves imprisoned in samsara's jail? So what we talked about in that verse was worldly deities, like we don't, you know, so much have them in our culture. But what we have is, like, I sometimes think of changing that to worldly refuges, even though it says deities in the Tibetan, because we do have a lot of worldly refuges, you know, escapes, things, you know, things that we turn to when we're stressed, for example. And so this verse is a reminder that those things can't really help us. They can't free us from samsara, whether it's the, you know, the pint of ice cream in the freezer or whatever else we turn to when we're stressed and, you know, turn on the TV, like something to distract us, some way of escaping. Those are imprisoned in samsara. They just keep us imprisoned in samsara's jail. Even though they may provide us momentary relief, and maybe we need to do that sometimes. You know, I'm certainly not going to try to tell others that they can't ever escape, because I do myself. But so if the worldly refuges can't protect us, who can? The three jewels which embody freedom's path are reliable protection without fail. Therefore, to seek refuge in Buddha, Dharma, Sangha, this is the way a bodhisattva trains. So always good to remember that this is what our path is about. This is, right, this is the basis of the whole path, is taking refuge in the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, the Buddha as, like, that's what we want to be. You know, obviously all of us are here because when we encountered the Buddha, when we encountered Buddhism, it really spoke to us. Like, for me personally, like, yeah, that's what I want to be. So the Buddha demonstrated that it's possible to exist in a certain way that is the culmination of wisdom and compassion. He gave us the Dharma, his teachings, which is the way that we can do that too. And so we take refuge in both of them, the Buddha as the example and the Dharma as the path. And then the Sangha, which is our teachers and also our fellow travelers on the path. We also take refuge in the Sangha. And I'm reading a lovely book by Thich Nhat Hanh, someone recommended to me. It's called Joyfully Together. It's about how to create a working Dharma community. And he really talks a lot about the Sangha as a real refuge. Like, we should be able to relate to each other as part of our refuge, our support on the path. So he talks about how to, like, create that in a Dharma community, like by having certain guidelines and certain ways of interacting together. So we are a refuge too for each other. So let us not forget that. The Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, even as we move on to ultimate bodhicitta and beyond, it's still based on Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. So, Dingo Chense Rinpoche. We're going to look today at Dingo Chense Rinpoche a little bit from Geshe Jampa Tegchok's Transforming the Heart, which is a Galupa, text, a Galupa commentary on the 37 practices. And then we're going to look at also Ken MacLeod, because he gives us, as I put in the, I don't know if people have had a chance to look yet, but I put a concise summary of the daily practice he suggests for cultivating generosity in the post. But we'll look at it more fully today if we have time. And again, if anybody wants to say anything, share anything, ask anything, that takes precedence over, like, just getting through the text, because we can all read those on our own. So on page 151, if you're looking at the book, which you don't need to be doing, Dingo Chense Rinpoche, he begins by saying, well, first he introduces at the top of the page that we are now in the sixth transcendent perfection. So I think Ken is going to talk a little bit, if we get to that, about the translation, the term. So it's paramita in Sanskrit. Paramita means to go to the other side. In English, that's been translated as perfections. So it's like the perfection of generosity, the perfection of patience, the perfection of moral discipline, and so forth. I like to call them transcending actions, which is very similar to the translation that Trungpa Rinpoche came up with. Transcending actions means that they are actions that take us to the other side. They propel our boat to the other shore, the shore of being free from suffering and being fully awakened. So these six, they are generosity and discipline or moral discipline, moral conduct, ethics. There's a lot of ways to, a lot of words we can use in English, none of which really captures what it is. But it's the best we can do. So generosity, moral discipline, patience, perseverance, or really joyful enthusiasm is another way that you can say that, because it does have a sense of joy in it. And actually, I like the translation diligence, because that comes from the Latin meaning to delight in something. But we don't really, we're not really in touch with that meaning now. So diligence sounds just as grim as perseverance to us. But that's the fourth one, is just sticking with it joyfully. Meditation and wisdom. So these are all of them, except maybe the cultivation of wisdom, can the first five, let's say, they are also ordinary virtues. I mean, any act of generosity we engage in is a virtuous action. It only becomes an action that frees us, helps free us directly from samsara, when it is combined with the sixth paramita of wisdom, when we really understand the emptiness of our experience. And we'll get into that more as we go along, and especially when we get to the wisdom paramita, as the Washington, D.C. Center as well, as we have been studying the wisdom paramita for some months now. So anyway, they're all ordinary virtues that we should engage in as much as we can. And then we'll add, as we understand emptiness more, understand the nature of mind more, then it will become more of a transcending virtue or a transcending action. Right now it's a meritorious action. If we don't do it with an understanding of emptiness, then it's generating merit. It's helping us to accumulate merit, which is what really propels us on the path. And then as we begin to understand emptiness more and more, the sixth paramita, it becomes a transcending action and actually pushes us directly, or pushes is probably not the right word, but we'll just use it for now, pushes us directly towards enlightenment, as opposed to simply being a supportive condition for enlightenment or awakening. So to go down to now to the actual paramita of transcendent generosity, he begins by saying, generosity is the natural expression of a bodhisattva's altruistic mind, free from attachment. And I was very taken with that way of expressing it, that when we are a bodhisattva, like when we really reach the bodhisattva level, which means when you really understand emptiness, like you have realized emptiness directly, it's just how you are. It's not an effort. We don't have to make ourselves be generous or remind ourselves to be generous. It's just a natural flowering of our progress on the path, of our realization of our development of wisdom and compassion. So he goes on to say, a bodhisattva, you know, at our level, we're still working at it, which is what all the rest of the commentary is about. So a bodhisattva is clearly aware of the suffering that can be caused by amassing wealth and by trying to protect and increase it. So therefore, a bodhisattva would never try to cling on to anything, because they know that clinging on to anything is the basic cause of suffering. So therefore, a bodhisattva, should he or she ever have any wealth or possessions, their first thought is to give it all away, using it to make offerings to the three jewels and to support those who are hungry or without food and shelter. So it's a natural outgrowth or development of realization of how things really are, that we don't even want to hold on to things. We don't want to keep things. It's more natural, it's more joyful and more natural to just give it all away. And I think we saw that a lot in Lamanorla Rinpoche, those of us who knew him well over the years. He never kept anything for himself. Funny things happened, you know, that we had to deal with, as it turned out. But in terms of material, sort of material things, he just would never let us give it. He would never keep anything. Like, people gave him stuff all the time. And that's meritorious. That's our generosity. And we're earning merit by giving something to Lama Marla Rinpoche. But he always gave it to the next person who walked in the door, like whatever it was. Sometimes he'd keep a jacket for a while and he'd wear it for a while and then he'd give it to somebody else. And he never let us fix up his room, as I said in the memorial service. He wouldn't even let us replace his carpet or anything. And we had to do that on the sly when he would be away, like in Taiwan or something, or Tibet. Like, now we have a few months. Let's replace the carpet. I'm sure he got quite a lot of offerings, and he always put them right back into KTC for the benefit of all beings. So it's natural when you reach like a certain level of realization. So on to the next page. We're just going to pick and choose a little bit here, although there is a lot in this commentary that's really worth reading. He says, if you are truly generous, you will be free of all difficulties and will possess whatever wealth you need to carry out altruistic deeds until you reach enlightenment. So if your motivation is truly to benefit beings and not to enrich yourself, then you'll always have more coming in, is the idea here. Or, you know, certainly as much as you need. Right, and then we're going to go down to the other side of the coin, people who are tied up in their own miserliness, people who do cling on to wealth and hold on to their possessions and so forth tightly. People tied up in their own miserliness, in contrast, will find themselves reborn in the realm of hungry ghosts, where not even the words food and drink are heard. So whether you really believe in the other realms or not, the hell realms and hungry ghosts and so forth, we can see that in human life. You know, people who are generous and give things away, those are very mentally relaxed people who have a natural caring, and it gives them joy to give things away and not joy to hoard things. Whereas people who are more tightly, you know, attached to their stuff, it's not a happy life. You're always in danger, as the Buddha said, of losing it, losing what you have. You have to protect it. And impermanence is going to take it away from you anyway. That's why we're encouraged at the end of life in the 7 points of mind training, one of the 5 strengths at the time of death is to just make sure you gave away all your possessions. As soon as you know, like when the end is coming, give it all away, because it's only going to cause you suffering and increase your confusion as you're dying, because you're going to lose it then anyway. And that's verse 4, right? To let go of attachment to this lifetime, to let go of attachment to friends. You're going to have to part ways eventually anyway, to let go of attachment to material possessions. Someone else is going to enjoy them eventually, or as Kathy's not here, but as she suggested, that it's going to go in the dumpster because the next generation doesn't really want our heirlooms, as it turns out, so they just go in the dumpster when we die. Even our body we're going to lose. So might as well give it away now. And so the less attachment we have when we're dying, the happier our mind is at the time of death. And we definitely don't want to be heading for the hungry ghost realm if possible. So then he goes on to, you know, this is the third line of the verse. Never hope for anything in return for an act of generosity. And do not expect as a result that in your next life you will be treated well or be happy and prosperous. So there's a couple of levels here of return that we could be expecting in gross or subtle ways. Like you give something to somebody, then maybe you think that they owe you something and you kind of wait for them to return the favor. So we're told that that's really not full generosity there. Right. And I'm going to get back to that in a second. And then we could have the subtle thought that by being generous now, we're setting up a better future for ourselves, karmically speaking. You know, and that's the middle level of practice where you engage in virtue with the thought of getting a better situation in this life or the next life. And so we're told, like, don't even go there either. And what I forgot to say that I had a note to myself about is, right, the very first line of Dingo Chenzi's commentary, generosity is the natural expression of a bodhisattva's altruistic mind, free from attachment, reminds me of the definition of generosity in the Ornament of Precious Liberation. and the definition. So Ornament of Precious Liberation is or you can do it through Rinku Tulku's Path to Buddhahood. The six paramitas are explained pretty fully in those sources. And each paramita has like a specific definition. Like what does it mean to be patient? What does it mean to have moral discipline? What does it mean to be generous? So what it means to be generous, according to Ornament of Precious Liberation, according to Gampopa, generosity means to give completely with a mind free of attachment. So that's a description of the bodhisattva level of generosity. And that's what we're aspiring to. When you give something, to just give it completely, not have any afterthoughts, not have any hesitations, not have any afterthoughts, not have any attachment, and not wish later that you hadn't given it away. To give completely with a mind free of attachment is the definition of generosity. So, so no hope for reward. Generosity is complete in itself. There is no need for any other reward than having made others happy. And we have that in our culture in the form of the words of Jesus. It is more blessed to give than to receive. So this is kind of saying the same thing. So moving to the next page, I just wanted to point out on page 153 near the top that we're starting to get into the ultimate bodhicitta level of generosity here, with Bingo Chenzi pointing out that recognizing all possessions to be like dreams or magical illusions, give them away as offerings or as charity without holding back. So that's starting to get into emptiness. Like, we don't really have this anyway. We don't really own this anyway. And recognizing that, or as I've quoted a few times in this class now, from I think Toni Bernhardt is her name. She wrote the book How to Be Sick, which is a very good book if you have any kind of chronic illness especially. She said that whenever she has sort of a precious object, like a beautiful vase or something, she just immediately thinks it's already broken. And then when it does get broken, well, it was already broken anyway. Like, that thought is in her mind. It was already broken anyway. Things are going to break. Lama Norla Rinpoche, when I was living at KTC and the Maitreya Center was still being built, he would come and teach in the women's retreat, and I was like an assistant there. And so he was getting older and less steady on his feet. This was a few years ago. And so I would usually escort him back to the house from the retreat, because it's a little bit like it's uneven and all that. Of course, he was better at navigating it than I was, but I would go with him, and that was really nice. And he would often detour into the Maitreya Center under construction. And one day he stopped and he said, "The Maitreya Center will be a ruin one day too." And I was like, wow, it's not even built yet. And we're thinking ahead to that, you know, always having impermanence in mind. So recognizing all possessions to be like dreams or magical illusions, give them away as offerings or as charity without holding back. So without getting into technical aspects of emptiness, that's a way to remember emptiness, to bring that, you know, understanding into our ordinary acts of generosity. Think of it as just an illusory thing. So now the sort of the heart of generosity is what is generosity? It takes three forms. And I'll just read this part. There are three kinds of generosity. The first is material giving, what we usually think of as generosity. A bodhisattva should give without reservation and without regret. If an offering is given with pure intention, its size is not important. So you get the same sort of credit, like merit credit, for a small act of generosity as you do for something big. And actually, Ken McLeod's going to get into that a little bit. So number one, give things away. And that's what the verse says. The verse itself is like, well, if in order to reach full awakening, I have to be at such a level of realization that I would even be able to give away my own body, then obviously I have to be able to give away stuff. Like, it goes without saying that I have to be able to give away any material object without attachment if I'm going to eventually have to be able to give away my body, to be like a real bodhisattva. And it's not something we force, by the way. It's just the natural progression of bodhisattva development. So material giving is what the verse refers to. But there's two other kinds of generosity. The second kind of generosity is to save life and to provide beings with protection from fear. So the way it's the term in Tibetan is to give freedom from fear, or to give fearlessness. And I learned something really interesting as I was studying for this. So, and we're going to get into that, because Geshe Jompa Tegchuk has a slightly different presentation that I'm going to share. It's four kinds of generosity. And so often, like, we ask, like, what does it mean to give fearlessness? Well, here it's spelled out to save life. Like, for example, the fish releases at the monastery. You buy up a lot of fish that were going to be used as bait or whatever, and you release them, and you've saved lives. And so you've saved them from fear of their life. But it's often also explained as, like, especially in our culture, as giving, like, support to people who are in distress. You know, somebody who's dying and they're afraid of dying, well, you could go sit with them. Or someone who's very sick, you could go sit with them and you could help them and you could feed them and so forth. And we'll talk about that more when we get to Geshe Jompa Tegchuk. So the third kind of generosity is giving the Dharma. A bodhisattva should do everything he can to make the sound of the teaching of Dharma resound in places where it has never been heard before. He can bring the Dharma to people in a way that they can put into practice and act in accordance with the Buddha's teachings, and so forth. And again, we're going to read that from Geshe Jompa Tegchuk for a fuller explanation. And then he tells the story here of, and this is often given as an example without telling the story, of the man who found it so hard to give anything away that the Buddha, this is someone who went to the Buddha. I didn't know that until I read it here. And I just can't, like, I just can't give anything away. So he had him practice giving it from the right hand to the left hand, just to get into the habit of what it feels like to actually transfer a possession. So we could start on whatever scale we can start on, and Ken's going to have some more advice about that, really practical, helpful advice. So we come to the end of Dingo Chense's commentary on page 154, and he explains what applying the wisdom paramita to generosity means, what it means that generosity is integrated with emptiness. So he says, the essence of generosity is non-attachment. Transcendent generosity is generosity that is free of the three limiting concepts. I actually really like this translation by the Padmakara Translation Committee. It's usually called the three spheres in all their translations, because it literally means the three spheres or the three circles. In the Tibetan, the Korsun, Korwasun, the three limiting concepts. That is attachment to there being any substantial reality of a person giving, any substantial reality of a recipient, and any substantial reality of an act of giving. To be free from such concepts is precisely how a paramita, in this case generosity, works as a cause of enlightenment. Now, I didn't pull out my Pema Chöder, but I'm going to do it now, because she expresses the same thing in a very nice way, which I included in my post. So she says, generosity is to give with no hope of return. We already covered that. Without an idea, and here we get into the three limiting concepts. You give without an idea of yourself as a generous person. You give, letting go of any fixation, my idea of a generous person, and without any idea of the act of generosity as a noble or special thing, because that's how we get fixated. That's how we cling when we are generous in an ordinary way. We think it's a big deal that we're giving a couple of dollars to a homeless person, or we're giving our friend this thing that we really love ourselves, but they liked it, so we're going to be generous and give it to them. It's not a big deal, she says. So really what we're working with when we're engaging in generosity is the grasping mind. We are working with our mental grip, our mental attachment to things. She says, outwardly, transcendent generosity, like understanding the emptiness of it, looks no different from outer generosity or ordinary generosity. Whether it's you being generous of money, time, or energy, you let it stretch you, and you let it open the heart or mind wider and wider. So that's what's happening when we give up the idea that it's a big deal that we're engaging in this act of generosity. It's a big deal for us, it's a big deal for the recipient, and the thing that's being given is a big deal. Letting go of that opens our heart and mind wider and wider. So I'll stop there with Panichidin. I just liked that she put it into terms that were a little more like how we would talk about it. So does anybody have any questions or comments before we look briefly at Geshe Jampa Tekchok? Okay, John, I'm going to unmute you.
In the book, I was looking at the list of the paramitas, and it lists concentration. Now, I'm assuming that one is replacing meditation. Is that correct?
Yeah. This is an old translation. This teaching was given in the early 90s, I think maybe even in the 80s. So there have been a lot of different... So the meditation paramita, I think the translation is actually samadhi, which is a state of mental focus. Like it's not just the act of sitting in meditation, but it's the meditative state of mind when it sort of kicks in and your attention is resting in an alert and relaxed way. That's called samadhi. So it's sometimes translated as concentration, but we don't really use that translation much anymore. And usually we say just the paramita of meditation. When we get to it all, I'll take a look at the Tibetan and probably have more to say about that. Anything else, John?
No. Okay.
But you are right. It is the paramita or transcending action of meditation is the fifth one. Anybody else? All right. Yes, Deidre, I'm unmuting you.
So the giving up the three spheres or the concepts that bind us, I don't remember when this happened, but I had this kind of experience of light giving to light.
Mm-hmm.
So if I consider myself like a dream, but having some kind of luminescence and everything else is, then it was just kind of, it was easier for me to do it that way rather than the concept of emptiness for a while, but basically light giving to light.
Yeah, that's the same as it's just a different way to say emptiness, I think. And one thing we've talked about is when we talk about things having no more solid reality than a rainbow, mm-hmm. It's like you could think it's a rainbow giving a rainbow to a rainbow. You know, it's that same thing. It's dependent on causes and conditions and perspectives coming together in a certain way to make this particular activity or action happen. But it's illusory in the same way. And it's gone when it's done. No pot of gold. I'm not sure how that fits in, but I'm sure there's some really clever thing one could say about that. Rainbow giving to a rainbow or light giving to light. Any way that we can sort of detach ourselves from the solidity of the thing. Mm-hmm. I think it's really helpful. Yes, I see you, Angela. Anything further, Deidre?
No.
Thanks for sharing that, and I'm gonna unmute Angela.
I went to church last week, Easter, and they were doing the candle, and that's what it's reminding me of, that you haven't lost anything when you light the candle from another candle. So that's kind of where I was going with it. So
very nice. We're getting some really good analogies here that I think they're all expressions of what we're getting at when we say there's no three spheres. There's just no solid reality to it. Okay, anything further, Angela?
No.
Okay, thank you. Anybody else? Okay, Dan Sheets in Richmond.
Yay. Yeah, I've always been real attached to the artwork I make, and I never really was ever comfortable with how to sell it and stuff too, because I was trying to do that. So I had like 50 paintings in my garage that were just collecting dust. So I just had like a on the spur art show in my backyard.
Oh, Oh, wow.
And the whole point was just to, like, tell people they could have them. Kind of, you know, blow their mind a little bit. People kept giving me money anyways. So it's just like they kind of named their price, I guess. And then other people just took things for free. And it was like,
I could use the money, right?
Yeah, I could always use the money. But going into it with you know, feeling like not making anything and just the joy of people coming and looking out in your backyard or all this artwork and stuff was great. And it was just really nice. And I think it helped me with the attachment of that I was having to these things and the idea of making money at it too. It was like very, it was really freeing, I guess. So
yeah.
Kind of cool.
Thank you for sharing that. I'm sorry I wasn't there.
It's a while ago.
But it sounds like what you're really working with is your attachment to your own artwork.
Right. Yeah.
To give away those things. Like you'll never get it back. Right.
Yeah. And the idea that trying to make money at it too, kind of does something to you a little bit. Yeah.
Well, we're going to get into that with Dharma teaching too. Geshe Jump Tech Talk's going to take us there. Get into the same thing with Dharma.
Cool.
Well, all right. Thank you. And I see that Charlotte has something to say.
Hi.
Hi.
I'm involved in the art world also. And I've had discussions with, like, I have a friend who is retired. He was an art professor at UC Berkeley. And, you know, he's been making, he's 76 years old. He's been making art all his life. And you get to a point where you're like, do I have anything more to say? And is this really meaningful? And the thing is that I always say that you're giving people beauty in their life, or you're giving them the, an expression of feeling something. You're raising their consciousness to whatever message the art is bringing, and that you need the money to continue to do that. And it's a talent that is, you know, you're expressing it to use your talents to contribute to the world. So I mean, we do, like, I make art too. I've really never, I always had a hard time with the gallery thing, and I've never really, I backed away from it. I completely relate to what you're talking about. But it is like, as long as you're not attached to it. When I moved from Hawaii to New York, I had a bunch of, I did ceramic art, and I threw it away, and people were screaming at me because I was like throwing it in the dumpster. And I was like, I can always make more. You know, it's like, that's another thing to think about. You can always make more.
Yeah.
And I think that's a good way of, like, I've always tried to, I think we've all, from my generation anyway, we've always tried to practice not being attached to stuff. I've always thought it's like the icing on the cake.
Mm-hmm.
Not the cake. That's the way I always looked at it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, thank you. I think that, like, the main point is not so much like that you shouldn't, if you're getting something in return, I think that's okay. It's the attachment part that we're working with. So, you know, if you have to make a living, then you have to make a living. And it, people send me donations, but we can't make that what our work is about. I think that's where we get into trouble, is that kind of attachment. Yeah, you had something else to say, Charlotte?
Well, I was just going to say that I really appreciate what Dan said, because I've gone through that too. It's a hard thing. It's nice to know someone else is thinking that.
Yeah. One artist to another. All right, anybody else before we take a look at Geshe Jump Tech Talk? All right, so we're just going to look very briefly at this. Again, it's a different presentation, because he's Galupa. It's almost exactly the same, but sometimes there's slight technical differences. And in the case of the four, I'm going to read his whole section on the four types of generosity, because it's a very nice explanation. And we also get an extra type of generosity, which I think bridges that, you know, like where we just call it we just have the generosity of giving fearlessness, and we include giving support in that. It's two different things here. So first, the generosity of giving material possessions. This includes giving food, money, medicine. We could insert artwork here, and even our own body. However, until we reach a certain level on the path, we are not allowed to give our body. So don't even think of going there until it's a natural thing. When you're ready to do it, it will be a completely natural thing. And until then, there's so much attachment. Even if we think we could do it, it's conceptual, and we would get ourselves into trouble because we would have attachment to it. So until we reach a certain level on the path, we are not allowed to give our body. When we are properly prepared and there is a real need, then it is appropriate to give it. But in the meantime, he says, at present, we can quote give our body, unquote, by using it to serve others. And I thought that was a very lovely suggestion, that we could think of that as giving our body. Like when we'd really rather be sitting in bed reading a book and somebody needs us to do something, that's giving our body, you know, in service. So I'm going to like put that on an index card or something. So second kind of generosity is the one that we don't have in our Kagyu list, the generosity of giving love. And he says this includes thinking, may others be happy, as well as actually caring for them. It is important for us not to get so absorbed in the abstract concept of all suffering mother sentient beings that we ignore those around us. And Kala Rinpoche said that too, that once we can get along really well with all the people in our family and who are close to us, then we can think about benefiting all sentient beings. If we can't get along with people close to us and we can't care for them and love them like unconditionally, then we're nowhere near the scope of all sentient beings. So not to ignore those around us, we should be warm and take care of those in our immediate environment as much as we can. So I think we include some version of this sometimes when we explain giving fearlessness, as that could mean giving support to someone who needs support, meaning emotional support, moral support, emotional support. So third, the generosity of giving fearlessness principally refers to saving the lives of others and freeing them from fearful situations. And so mostly that turns out, unless you're a superhero, that turns out to be like animals is the tradition in Tibet. You save, you know, you buy yaks that are about to be slaughtered, or you buy chickens that are about to be slaughtered. There's lots of stories about Lama Narla Rinpoche and others doing that in India and Tibet. And then the fourth one, the generosity of giving the Dharma, means sharing the Dharma with others by giving teachings or initiations, for example. But he cautions us here, the generosity of giving Dharma must be practiced with a motivation that is not mixed with disturbing attitudes. And by disturbing attitudes, he means the emotional poisons, not mixed with desire, anger, jealousy, pride, and so forth. He says, that is, we must take care not to wish for money, appreciation, or reputation in return for teaching the Dharma. The more pure our motivation, the more it is solely to benefit others, the more effective our gift of Dharma will be. When we become an Arya, meaning like a technical bodhisattva, any teaching we give will be of great benefit to others. And then he says, for all of us, we can, and this applies to all of us. You know, I'm technically a Dharma teacher, so I have to be very, very careful about this, tainting my motivation to share the Dharma with worldly concerns. But all of us might be in a position to share the Dharma in one way or another. So we all want to keep our sharing of the Dharma as pure as possible in terms of motivation. He says, we can also give the Dharma in unassuming ways, such as by helping a person with problems by explaining the Dharma perspective to them without using any Buddhist words. So we don't want it to be proselytizing, and we don't want it to be, I don't know how to say it exactly, but it can be very annoying to people to get the Buddhist sermon on like, well, this is what a Buddha would do. Well, you know, that doesn't help if like it's annoying or sort of feels condescending to the person. So if they're not Buddhist, we can put it in non-Buddhist language. We could share with them, like, the ways that you can look at someone who's harming you from Gampopa, just say, well, you know, they're not in control of their own mind, really. They're just not themselves. Or, you know, or anyway, there's a lot of those. Right, he said we can also give the Dharma by reciting our prayers out loud so that the animals and insects in the area hear them. So, yeah, we have a few minutes left to look at our practical advice from Ken McLeod in his commentary in our Reflections on Silver River. So it's a very nice commentary, but we're just going to do a little bit of it, the practice. So he says, how do you practice generosity? So do we have to wait, like for the homeless person on the street corner and the light is red, so we're coming to a stop and we remembered to put a few dollars where we could get to it easily? I often find myself in that situation. Oh, darn, you know, by the time I get my wallet open, like people are honking at me. So sometimes you have to pass. So how do you practice generosity if, like, your maybe opportunities aren't just presenting themselves to you constantly? He says, once a day, you make a resolution that once a day, give something you own to someone else. If you're not very social, if you're not out and about a lot, there are days when I don't see another person necessarily, but I can feed the birds. You know, Lama Narayana often advise you, like, people who, with a sickness, he'll say, you know, practice generosity, you know, feed the birds, put up a bird feeder. So he says you may give a paperclip or a flower. It could be something as inconsequential as that. But the object has to be physical. So just a kind word is not going to count here, although it is a kind of generosity. And I think in a pinch, if you don't have somebody to give something to, you could do that. You could throw a few crumbs outside for ants to eat. You could be creative if you're not like working in an office or something and there's somebody to give a paperclip to. Here, have a paperclip. Probably helpful if it's something that they need, but again, it's even generosity to give from the right hand to the left hand if you don't have another way to practice. So you may give a paperclip or a flower, but the object has to be physical and it has to be yours. It may be expensive or it may be inconsequential. It may be old or new, but it has to be yours. Something you can give away. It has to be an actual object too, so that you have the physical experience of giving, not just an imagined one. So he goes on to say, give one thing to someone once a day. That is the practice. Do not make a big deal of it. In other words, do not tell anyone that you are doing this practice. Charlotte, did you have something you wanted to say?
You make offerings at your shrine in the morning. Right.
That's true.
Is that generosity?
It is. It is generosity. I think Ken's encouraging us to do it on a more mundane level, but that definitely counts as generosity.
And then when you empty the offering water, you pour it on the plants.
Right. Yeah, you can do that. Or I throw my morning water offering that has cereal in it. I throw that out for the birds every day. They wait for it. But I think he might be asking us to do something that's also outside our daily routine. Dan.
Also, like on the spot tonglen, you know, is good.
Yeah, on the spot tonglen is good. Are you saying as a way to practice generosity?
Yeah, like if you don't have the money to give to the homeless person.
Yeah. Oh, sure. Yeah, definitely. Yeah. Definitely. Tonglen is good. Or just wishing for them to be happy. When I throw the ants out of my kitchen, I always wish for them to land well. But anyway, so however we're going to practice this, he is being very specific here. It has to be a physical object, and we can't make a big deal out of it. It has to be something that belongs to us. And then he says to take the practice deeper, so it's not just like giving something away and being done with it. He says, open to whatever arises in you when you give. Hope of reciprocation. Wanting to be seen as generous. You know, we're told not to have any attachment to it, but that's a work in progress. So Ken is encouraging us to just be aware of what is arising. Maybe we aren't giving it with complete lack of attachment yet. And that's okay. We have to work up to that. So what we want to do in the meantime is be aware of what is arising. So wanting to be seen as generous, desire for control, expectation of thanks, sadness, joy in the giving, relief, loneliness, attachment to the gift, irritation with the exercise. I really don't want to give away a paperclip today, but I'm doing it. let all the internal stuff that gets in the way of giving be there. We don't have to pretend that we're giving without attachment. We want to really be in tune with what our mental state is. Let all the internal stuff that gets in the way of giving be there, along with all the physical and emotional sensations, stories, and associations. Do this every day and see what happens over the course of weeks and months. So you may notice something. He says we'll notice a shift over time. I'm not going to read that part. I'm also, because we're out of time, I'm going to skip the part about the translation, but if you have the commentary, you can read that. So also, he also takes it a level deeper. Like, he's taken it to the level of just being aware in the present moment of whatever is arising, which is really more of a shine, calm abiding approach. But he takes it to the level of insight of vipassana as well, and I'm sure you can imagine how he's going to do that if you haven't read it, because it's the same as meditation. How do you practice the perfection of generosity? Like, not just generosity, but now transcendent generosity, with, like, connecting it with emptiness, connecting it with the nature of mind. He says, every day, when you give your object, open to the whole experience and ask, who is giving? Do not answer, like same thing we asked in the meditation, like, who's the one who's experiencing this? Who or what? So you just let that question arise. He says, do not answer the question. Do not think about the question. Just ask the question. So we have, like, in this simple act of daily generosity, we have a complete practice from the level of just ordinary generosity and accumulating merit to letting it help us be aware in the present moment of everything that's arising in the present moment, in all, like, whatever emotions are coming up and so forth, and then taking it even deeper to the ultimate level of who or what is engaging in this act of generosity. And just not trying to say. Yes, Valerie, I'm going to unmute you.
So when you're saying who is giving, mm-hmm. not expecting an answer, mm-hmm. is the idea that the answer will come to you?
No, the idea is that there's no answer. Now, I don't know if you've had a chance to work with Ken's meditation that I emailed a while back. Or if you were here for that particular class where he takes us through all the exercises. And the final one is you ask yourself, who or what is experiencing all this? Just ask and look. Don't try to figure it out. Rest in the looking. Then let the looking go and rest. So the idea is, like, when an emotion comes up and you go, where is that emotion located? You can't say. Like, you can't say it's here, but you also can't say it's not anywhere. But you can't pinpoint the location. So same thing with that, the idea of the one who's doing the activity is, like, when you really look at it, looking at the mind itself, you can't locate it. And if this is a kind of meditation you haven't done yet in the past, then you don't need to worry about it. But what he's encouraging us to do is to take it to the ultimate bodhicitta level simply by sort of letting go. What we're doing is we're letting go in that moment of the three limiting concepts, or the three spheres of I am giving this to this other person. And you actually ask yourself the very deep question of who exactly is doing this? Like, where is that located? In my mind, where is that located? It's not like, is it Valerie or Deidre? You know, it's like, where is the location of the generosity? I see you raising your eyebrows, so maybe that this is something that you haven't encountered before. Oh, sorry, I just muted you by accident.
Okay. No, I've been, because it's that there's no gift, there's no giver, there's no receiver. Mm-hmm. Those always, I don't get them.
Really. Yeah, and so he's giving us a way to start to get it. So you can't, if you just go straight to, oh yeah, there's no giver, there's nobody giving, there's nothing being given, and there's no recipient, that's conceptual. And it helps you to know that, but it's conceptual, and it's not a realization. But so the way to start to realize that is to ask, who is giving? And if you're just not used to that way of question, that's vipassana meditation, lakthong meditation. If you're not used to that, then it's maybe hard to get an entry into that. So what he's asking us to do, because he doesn't know who's reading this book. Like, anybody could buy this book and read it. So he's not trying to, like, give us Vipassana meditation as a whole, but he's giving us, like, a little entryway into the nature of mind, just encouraging us to ask the question. And since it's, he's telling us don't try to answer it, you don't have to do anything. You're just saying, okay, who's giving? And you don't even have to understand what the question means. Like, you could just give something away, give away the paperclip and go, okay, where is that giving taking place? Who is the source of that impulse of generosity? And you don't try to answer it. You just ask the question. So you don't have to figure anything out. You don't have to know the meaning of it. Does that help at all?
No.
Okay. That's okay. Because it's exactly the point, is that you can't say. Like, we're in non-conceptual. He's leading us into non-conceptual territory here. And our concepts cannot follow us there. So you're in exactly the right place, Valerie. You're
good.
Exactly
That's
where
good.
You need to be. There's no fault here whatsoever. So you ask without expecting to understand what it is you're asking, and definitely without any concept that there could be an answer to it. And so report back next week and let us know how that went. Anybody, like, this is not an easy practice to work with, this looking at the source of, it's the same question. Like, when Lamanar Rinpoche gave meditation instruction, often the instruction he gave was rest in the essence of whatever's arising, or rest in the essence of the one who is thinking that thought. Like, what does that mean? It means exactly the same thing as this. And you don't have to know what the essence is. Like, it doesn't help to be able to say in words what the essence is. It's like you're resting in a place that's non-conceptual. So if you're going, this makes no sense to me, you're exactly there. And you don't have to dwell on it. It makes no sense. You just dwell in that not knowing what it means. Does that make any sense? You just let yourself rest there. Like, what does that mean?
Well, it's a clear instruction. So, I mean, that I can do.
Yeah. Yeah. So, but don't expect it to get any clearer. Like, you're learning to rest in the unclearness of it.
Okay.
That's the instruction. So thank you for helping us clarify that, so to speak, Valerie.
You're welcome.
All right. We're really out of time now. We've run a few minutes over, which I rejoice in because I think it was a really good discussion. Hope it doesn't cause a problem for anyone. We are now going to dedicate the merit without further ado. And if anybody wants to linger for a few minutes, I can linger for a few minutes. Were you waving, Dan?
I actually have to take off for work.
Okay. You were waving goodbye. Okay.
Yeah. All right. Okay. Thank you.
Bye. Bye-bye. Okay. So if anybody wants to hang out for a few minutes, you're welcome to do that. We can talk about things further. Bye, Beatrice. It looks like you might have to go too. Anybody who has to leave, just think you dedicate the merit. All right. And the rest of us will chant the actual verses. This merit may it win omniscience, defeat my faults the enemy, then from the rough and stormy sea of birth, old age, death, and disease, from this ocean of samsara, may I liberate all beings. They know things in their true existence, Kuntu, Zangpo, and Manjushri. To train myself in their example, I dedicate this practice fully. May every being through this practice completely gather merit and wisdom, attaining the two sacred bodies that merit and wisdom emanate, the blessings of the Buddha Kayas, the blessings of changeless Dharmata, the blessings of the steadfast Sangha. This dedication please fulfill. And let our minds come to rest just for a second. Just relaxed and alert. And I'll unmute everybody. Okay, everybody's unmuted. And if you want to hang out and chat for a few minutes, I'm good with that. And if anybody needs to leave, farewell.
Lama?
Yes, Valerie.
Is Lama Norla, was he at the level where whoever they are go look for